taking note of my suits. Nothing gets past. Nothing gets past you. Quickly, the president had a drop-by meeting today with the new UN Secretary General designate to Ban Ki-moon, Foreign Minister of the Republic of Korea. The president congratulated the foreign minister on his election. The foreign minister thanked him for U.S. support. The president urged the foreign minister to address UN management and reform issues and promised U.S. help during his tenure in making the UN more effective. The president said he was very much looking forward to working with Mr. Ban when he becomes Secretary General. The two discussed the North Korean nuclear test and the United Nations Security Council resolution. The president noted his determination not to let Kim Jong-il threaten peace in the region. The president said Secretary Rice is visiting the region to discuss implementation of the Security Council resolution, and the foreign minister said he was leaving for Seoul tonight and would meet her there. The president said, we want the UN and its new Secretary General to succeed, and we'll do all we can to assist him. Terry.
Now that the president has signed the military commission bill, what happens next? How quickly before the suspects at Guantanamo are brought to trial?
It's still, as I was explaining yesterday, it's going to take some time. You now have a procedure in place. You still have all the preliminaries involved in putting together court operations. Not only do you have to assemble the commissions and get the people for them, you also have to allow prosecution and defense to prepare for any upcoming commissions. My understanding is weeks, perhaps months, month or two. I don't think there's any formal determination. Obviously, we want the wheels of justice to start moving as quickly as possible, but you also have to be cognizant of the fact that the defendants do have their rights and they need to be able to prepare as well.
So you think it'll be a month or two at the outside?
I think it's a month or two at least.
And the interpretations that were required by the law that are to be published in an executive order?
Well, what it says is the president's authorized to do an executive order. I'll read you the language in a moment. The president's senior advisors are going to make recommendations as to the appropriate steps. Once you have a law passed, then you have the people in the executive branch try to interpret how to make it happen. So there will be further consultations with Congress and consideration of additional legal guidelines and issuance of an executive order. So that's they're going to try to walk through all the
executive orders published in the Federal Register, right? Your intention is...
Yeah, let me read to you, because it's... I'll just read you the language. It sort of speaks for itself, but it's worth going through and with your forbearance. It says, as provided by the Constitution in this section, the President has the authority for the United States to interpret the meaning and application of the Geneva Conventions and to promulgate higher standards and administrative regulations for violations of treaty obligations which are not grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. The President shall issue interpretations described by subparagraph A, which I just read to you, by executive order published in the Federal Register. Any executive order published under this paragraph shall be authoritative except as to grave breaches under Common Article 3 and so on. So that's the language.
So he does have then to publish...
Well, we will, again, there. Well, we'll see.
On this
signing, says he's authorized to do so.
On the signing, there have been a flurry of press releases from prominent Democrats who voted against this, including Senator Feingold, who said, we'll look back on this day as a stain on our nation's history. Is that to respond to any of those?
Senator Feingold thinks it is a stain to detain people who have killed thousands of Americans, to question them, to put together, on the basis of that questioning, to intervene in a number of terrorist plots that could have killed many more Americans, and now have a process that's not only consistent with international law but with our statutes, to bring people to justice, to question them, to detain them, to question them, and to try them. That hardly seems a stain on our national honor. As a matter of fact, it's an example of the way in which the United States doesn't care for the rights of people who don't care for ours.
Senator Feingold, in his release, said this law allows the government to seize individuals on American soil, detain them indefinitely with no opportunity to challenge their detention in court, and permits an individual to be convicted on the basis of coerced testimony and convicted under these rules to be put to death.
And Senator Feingold has been saying this for some time. As you know, the CIA program that the president alluded to deals with people who have been seized elsewhere. You know, this is where you're basically trying to, if I had to parse each and every bit of that statement, it would keep me quite busy. Let me just give you the basics here. What we have is a Military Commissions Act. that in response to the United States Supreme Court's decision in the Hamdan case, involves congressional authorization for military commissions, which have been a factor of American justice in times of war since the founding era. What we have done is put together, with again, in consultation with Congress, ways in which we can, in keeping with our treaty obligations and laws, question enemy combatants, bring them to justice, or in many cases, if we've been trying to do at Guantanamo, try to repatriate them to either to home nations or nations under which they have been charged with criminal offenses, and who, upon receiving them, will observe and honor their human rights.
Can you tell us how quickly the CIA interrogators will begin resuming their questioning?
No. Let me explain.
To the CIA program.
Yes.
That means you're going to continue secret prisons and torture. We know it, not as you interpret it.
No, I don't think
that's deprivation of sleep and so forth.
First, as you know, torture is illegal. Furthermore,
we've seen photographs. We've seen
What photograph have you seen of torture?
Abu Ghraib
is something that was a criminal. It was, in fact, a criminal infraction for which people were charged.
No, it doesn't go on above Bagram and
are you saying that the people, the U.S. servicemen,
that there have been allegations all the way through that we don't treat, that we coerce
on the other hand, on the other hand, the International Committee of the Red Cross regularly visits Guantanamo and talks to everyone there and has, in fact, seen the high-value detainees. The United States has made it possible. Interestingly, many of the people making these particular allegations have refused to go to Guantanamo and assess for themselves what's going on. Instead, they've based it on hearsay testimony. The United States has set up a system, and General Hayden talked about this, that goes through extraordinary lengths to make sure that the questioning is done in a way that is effective and also humane. You have somebody... Helen, I'm not sure that you're going to trust anything that people tell you in good faith. It's the law, and the people who engage in this are very proud of their professionalism and the steps in which they take. For instance, I'll go back through it again because it's probably worth reminding people. You have folks who have to have demonstrated maturity before they're even allowed to get into the questioning program. There are 250 hours of original training. Plus, you have to have 40 hours working with somebody who has already been authorized to do training before you can engage in an interrogation. Also, in any interrogation, there's an outside observer who at any point, for any reason, can interrupt the questioning, saying that they think that it's inappropriate. And
we
it can
know
be
what the guidelines are in terms of how they're coerced or interrogated.
The government will not tell you the precise questioning techniques for the reasons that have been outlined many times before, which is that you do not want to give those who are apprehended or terrorists the ability to plan in advance for techniques that might be used. However, there are pretty extensive guidelines, not only in this particular legislation, but also in U.S. law and international treaty obligations, that not only torture is completely out of the question, but also so-called grave offenses that have been outlined in the Geneva Conventions and, in fact, are mentioned in this law as well. For instance, cruel or inhuman treatment, performing biological experiments, murder, mutilation or maiming, intentionally causing serious bodily injury, rape, sexual assault or abuse, taking hostages. Those are obviously the gravest infractions, but there are also standards within the law in Section 6 of the law that govern the ways in which people may conduct these things.
But you're not suggesting this is an easy question and answer session.
You know, I'm not suggesting anything. You may have seen one of the stories where one of the most effective interrogators was described as a grandmotherly person who made people friends. You got to keep in mind that ultimately you want people to have a condition where they are going to be cooperative. And beyond that, I'm simply not going to go into techniques.
Special legislation for that.
Well, don't know.
You said yet that classified on whether we believe in waterboarding.
No, I said I'm not going to talk about waterboarding, nor am I going to talk about any other technique, real or imagined. That's been our position from the start.
So who will the president convince Americans that the kind of interrogation and the kind of pursuit of terrorists is something they can be proud of?
Well, the question is, it's interesting. If you live in an atmosphere where people are automatically going to assume that people are serving their nation or doing so dishonorably, and that would have to be the assumption here, the people doing the questioning, in fact, are rogue actors and not people acting scrupulously within the law and proud of what they do, then there's absolutely no way to persuade somebody. People are not going to be able to see this. However, we have tried to make it as transparent as possible by inviting in regularly the International Committee of the Red Cross. You guys can go to Guantanamo anytime you want. Many of you have been there.
Published in the Federal Register?
Well, again, that is one of the things that is going to be, we're now at the stage where, in consultation with the Department of Justice, you figure out the proper way to enact the law, and I can't tell you.
But what is it? It's not lists of behavior, it's rough guidelines. What will be?
Well, again, I would refer you to the language I just read to you, because that is the language that determines what would be published in the Federal Register.
What would be the consequences of a second North Korea nuclear test?
I think the consequences of a second North Korean nuclear test would be the further isolation of North Korea. What you've seen already in the case of the first test is that the United States and the Chinese are working more closely together than ever before, and I dare say that they would become even closer as strategic partners in trying to guarantee safety in the Korean Peninsula. Also, if the North Koreans think that in doing such a thing, in sort of testing the cooperation of the parties of the five-party talks, they're going to be disappointed because they're going to find out that the parties, in fact, are resolved to make sure that the North Koreans renounce nuclear testing and renounce nuclear weapons. And we've offered a whole series of positive inducements and hope they'll take advantage. Jim?
What do you have on that?
We don't share that, Jim.
North Korea is calling the sanctions a declaration of war. Would you pursue tougher sanctions if they go ahead with a second test?
I think at this point you go ahead and allow the sanctions regime that has been adopted by the UN Security Council begin to work. Good heavens, you've got the Secretary of State right now just making her way to the region. She's taking off today so that she can consult with allies in terms of the enactment of those resolutions. I think it would be premature to talk about any further steps.
To follow on Stu's questions a little bit,
yeah.
I've seen the president ask several times about Kim Jong-il,
yeah.
And he sort of doesn't go there necessarily.
Right.
But I think it's a fair question now, as Americans are beginning to hear there may be a second test, the third test. In the face, this guy, in the face of opposition that includes his biggest trading partners, people you can usually count on,
yeah.
is continuing to go down this road. So what is the impression that you're working under about Kim Jong-il's sanity?
Well, one of the things you do is, in a situation like this, we're just not going to get involved in the business of trying to do a psychological evaluation of the dear leader. What we do is we take a look at his actions, and we respond with actions which we think are going to be louder than words or psychological profiles.
Isn't it germane as you're determining how to respond to him? You have to ask, what do we got here?
Yes, we do.
And what kind of answers do you come up with?
Well, those are answers that people within the intelligence community and president share, but those are not things that I think are particularly constructive to share publicly.
Let me ask you one on Iraq, because a lot came out yesterday about the confidence the government may have in Maliki,
yeah.
or the questions they may have.
Yeah.
Does the prime minister have a functioning government, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, it's a government, and again, I'll go back to the meeting we had when he brought most of his cabinet here to the States. If you take a look at the security situation, there are clearly difficulties in Baghdad and some of the other areas, and that is...
The point is beyond difficulties, isn't it?
Well, I want to be careful, because if I use too colorful a word, then all of a sudden that becomes a headline, so I'm trying to give you a thoughtful and precise answer. And it is this. The security situation is the biggest challenge facing the Maliki government right now. You do have ongoing successes when it comes to developing an economic infrastructure with energy and other things. So some of those metrics that we've talked about in the past are improving. On the other hand, you've got a security situation that you really have to deal with. So what he told the president yesterday, and it appears in some places in the USA Today interview, is that he's got three different, he's approaching the business of trying to create peace from three angles. Number one, you got to deal with the security stuff, using force against bad guys. Number two, you also have to have the political solution, which is persuading some of the bad guys to come off the sidelines and join the political process. And number three, for those who have been fighters on the other side at some point, you want them to lay down arms under the rubric of reconciliation. And at the same time, you got to have something for them, and that means jobs, economic opportunities. So he's talking about all those. In addition, as we've said a lot of times, Jim, one of the real challenges is getting the police right, because the police have been a problem. General Casey said it. I've said it many times. And that is one of the things that the Prime Minister is focusing on. He's already mentioned that there have been some shakeups at the Interior Ministry. He's determined to get that piece right. There have been ongoing talks with Sunni tribal leaders. There are about 100 tribal leaders who had a meeting with the government about a week ago. You have seen some positive statements out of some of the Shia leaders. There's an understanding on both sides that people who are trying to foment sectarian violence are doing their very best to pull. Now, what we do have in our assessment is that you still have an intact, functioning government. You've got a military that becomes more capable, and you've got to work on some of the other issues.
In terms of these metrics that you talk about, if you're making the case, this guy's really making it happen there. What do you throw out as the single biggest success for Maliki right now? Let's leave the security situation aside right now, because it's kind of hard to point to.
Well, then I'll tell you what. I'll go back and get my charts and graphs, and I'll send you something. But, I mean, I get a briefing.
You're asking the question right now. What's the big...
Well, again, but if you expect big, it's a war. And in a time of war, you have acts of violence, either concentrated or sporadic, that tend to capture people's attention. And I think what Americans want to know is, are we in it to win, and is this guy serious? And the answer to both are yes. That's maybe the most important thing. If you want to know the biggest success, Maliki hasn't backed down. The prime minister is saying to the forces that want to commit violence, you're not going to win. And in the face of all else, that is not only an act of courage, but an act of leadership.
Do you think that's enough for Americans right now? Maliki hasn't backed down as the biggest success?
You're going to have to decide. I mean, his job is to do what's right for the Iraqis. He's not sitting around reading American polls. His job is to make sure that the forces of violence, interior and those who are coming in from the outside, don't win. And we're determined to help him succeed. Whoa. Okay, we'll do this, and then we've had some problems in getting to the back rows, so I want to make sure that we get to the other rows, too.
Go ahead. What's the administration's policy when it comes to talking to insurgents in Iraq?
Well, there have been a number of conversations with people who have said that they're willing to negotiate and talk about a peaceful path, and we're willing to do that. But again, the lead player in all this is the government of Prime Minister Maliki. And that is also something that's involved in his reconciliation process. He has had a number of meetings, and some of the meetings with tribal leaders were designed to achieve that goal. He talks about the effect. Well, again, it's not as if you got a headquarters that says Insurgency Central, and you've got this guy who is the CEO of the insurgency. It doesn't quite work that way, as you know. What you have are sometimes very loosely affiliated groups, and so therefore, you rely not only on the expertise, but also the motivation of the Iraqis to be dealing with the people who may have the most influence. That, again, is why you look to tribal leaders. It's why you look to important Shia religious and political leaders. And we'll continue to do that.
So that channel, it sounds like, right now, but nothing direct with the U.S. necessarily having military...
Well, again, I don't even know. Again, what you're posing here is a situation that doesn't quite make sense, because... Again, one of the reasons, there are two things insurgent leaders don't want. They don't want you to know who they are, and they don't want you to know where they live. Under such circumstances, it's very difficult to have regular meetings with them. So what you really have here is a situation in which the Iraqis have their own way of communicating, sometimes through third parties. But let's reiterate, reconciliation is a key part of what the Prime Minister is trying to do. And it's very important to, and he is trying to be as creative and also as exhaustive as possible.
Have a strong voice, though, in helping to determine who is a terrorist and who is an insurgent. What if someone has American the blood of American soldiers on his hand. Is that someone the U.S.
Well,
would be
again,
okay
the,
with
again, the United
the
States is.
We
are really no. This is. I think we've been through this before. The prime minister is the person who will make the determinations on how to proceed. What we're doing is we're operating in a support role, but we're certainly not going to dictate orders to him. It would be inappropriate. April.
What are the accountability measures within this this act as far as the secret prisons, some of the national...
Again, we don't talk about that program. So what I will tell you is that people... But it, what happens here, if you look at the law, it says that anybody who deals... who violates the law with anybody who's within American jurisdiction or administration, they're going to be punished. And it outlines a series of punishments, and it also outlines the acts for which they could be punished.
So you're saying there are accountability measures?
Of course. For anybody who is under American jurisdiction.
The ICRC can't visit these places, okay? Which you said earlier.
So far they haven't, but I'm not...
Prisons?
We're not going to. What you're trying to do is to question me about something that we don't talk about. So,
if it's secret, you've got to keep it secret.
That is correct.
Someone questioning the accountability. Who's checking to make sure you're following this?
Well, again, if you take a look at the techniques that have been laid out, let me put it this way. I think for any of you who've been out working with, dealing with the men and women who are in the American military. You're impressed by the professionalism. The people who are involved in these programs are the most mature of folks involved in this kind of activity, and they take very seriously their professional charge. I think it is reasonable to assume that if something bad happens, you'd find out about it.
The government stopping the Guantanamo Bay detainees' suits from going forward.
I'm sorry, what?
The government is stopping Guantanamo detainees' suits today, I believe, were filed.
I don't know anything about it. You call me back later, and I'm not sure I know what you're talking about.
Tony, it seems like we can't ask a question about this without impugning the integrity of the people conducting the...
Well, that would be correct, because what you're... No, what you're... Well, sure it is. I mean, what you're saying is, the insinuation is, perhaps I'm wrong, Jim, but you're asking what happens if they break the law or commit torture, correct?
Which is what, never happened before in the history of the government?
Well, I tell you what, I think what you do have are people, there's a record within, not only within this administration, but also within military circles, where when people misbehave, they take it very seriously. They see it as a blemish upon their honor and their responsibility. So there are written into this law real punishments for people who get involved, who break the law.
Right.
And so what you're saying is, even if we can't see them, how can we trust them? Isn't that your question?
The question is, how do you allow people, how do you impart any degree of transparency, which I think has been a sort of underpinning of all parts of our legal system.
Well, but on the other hand, you're dealing with an unusual situation here. Transparency has never been part of the bargain when you are dealing with...
Accountability's
there. It's written into the law. And the only way accountability doesn't exist is if you believe that the military is not committed to it and that the people involved in the program are not committed to it.
Was Congress impugning the military by writing this law in the first place?
No, as you were...
They saw fit to write laws... regulating this behavior, isn't that also impugning the...
No, as a matter of fact, we got to this point because of a Supreme Court decision.
But Congress still wrote the law, and they wrote infractions and punishments in the law.
Exactly.
They must not be presuming that everybody in the military is going to be 100%
No, I think they wanted to make sure... No, but if you recall, the debate was, first, under Hamdan, the Supreme Court said, Congress, you do it. So that's why Congress did it. Secondly, Congress also had to figure out a way to incorporate Common Article 3, which does, in fact, deal with infractions of this sort. So as part of the regular process of doing this definition, it's not impugning. It's, in fact, giving specificity to the items in Common Article 3. And you can't do that without laying out the conditions that would fall under...
I'm sorry. The logic of what you're saying is that the military should not be subject to laws these days.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
To presuppose that they may do something
wrong. No.
We can't do that.
No, it's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that they are subject to laws. What you're saying is if we can't look over their shoulders, how do we know the law applies?
Exactly. How can you enforce a law if you can't...
Well, again, because you do have accountability, you have outside actors looking in on every juncture. It is built in. And therefore, there are measures that are taken within this. And they are independent of the questioning that's going on, but they've also been trained in taking a look at what the proper guidelines are for interrogation under the law, trying to make sure that people do not go beyond the boundaries of proper interrogation. These are people who work for the federal government and are charged with doing it. They're independent of the questioning. Never mind. Go ahead.
Are you expecting?
No, it's it would be snarky, and that's not worthy of me.
Are you expecting this law to end up back before the Supreme Court and the legal team?
No. I mean, our legal team spent a great deal of time working hard on this. One of the reasons you didn't have, for instance, a signing statement is that we think it all passed constitutional muster. And the people who worked on it have worked very hard, so we'll see.
It's already under challenge even before it's been signed.
Well, then in that case, it will end up before court, but we'll see what the courts say.
Do you think, this has been described as a compromise. The president basically got everything he wanted, didn't he?
Pretty much, yeah.
Tony, two questions. Does the president believe that the American Revolution led by George Washington should be compared to Hamas with their charters, Article 15, which calls for the destruction of Israel, and Article 7, which calls for the killing of Jews?
No.
In Secretary Condoleezza Rice's speech last week to the American Task Force on Palestine, she said, quote, "I believe that there could be no greater legacy for America than to help bring into being a Palestinian state for a people who have been humiliated too long," end of quote. My question, since the Palestinian Authority's president, Mahmoud Abbas, co-founded Fatah with Arafat and funded the Munich massacre of the Israeli Olympic team and wrote his PhD thesis denying the existence of the Holocaust, how can the president agree with Secretary Rice that it would be a great legacy to have a Palestinian state run by Abbas and Hamas?
I believe he did not say run by Abbas and Hamas, but on the other hand, Prime Minister Abbas is also demonstrated a willingness to pursue democracy and work directly with Israel, and he stands absolutely behind what the Secretary of State said.
You said he's ready to recognize Israel, are you saying?
Well, I think we've long since recognized Israel.
No,
are you talking about Abbas? I'm sorry. Yes, they've talked about recognizing Israel within the context of a settlement. Okay, Victoria.
When the high-profile prisoners were transferred to Guantanamo, were told that the CIA prisons were empty.
Yes.
Are they still empty?
That I will not answer.
See, we were told that they were empty, so you told us
they were
something.
Empty. Well, that's
told
what.
Something about them.
Yes.
So they weren't entirely secret.
That is correct, but I am not at liberty to make any further announcements about what they are.
Initially, you told us that they didn't exist, and then the president told us all about them, so they ceased to exist.
No, what the president said is that these were people who were detained. I don't believe anybody's ever talked about secret prisons. They've talked about detention facilities, whether they qualify as secret prisons or not. I don't know.
Well, that's just language. I mean, you acknowledge.
Well, no, it's not just language. In any event, I'm not at liberty to go any further into what may or may not be happening, and I will leave that to the CIA director.
To know if, not necessarily who, but just to know if there's anybody there.
Because that's just the way it is.
You said
I said it was dormant during the period. What happened was, when there was no law, it was described as being dormant. This is a program that could no longer go forward. And I am not at liberty to divulge any further details about what may have happened in the last 2 hours since the law was signed, or hour and a half.
Can I just go back one more time?
Yeah, sure.
I'm trying to develop some sense of a way to get my arms around this. If you have a police department in the United States conducting interrogation, and they police themselves, and the public never has any idea about what's going on behind their closed doors, by way of interrogation techniques, that probably wouldn't, it doesn't smack of something that's American. It probably runs, and to question those police officers, it's not an un-American thing, is it, to question?
Well, as you know, there are, within police departments, internal affairs departments, which take a look at things, and there are analogous departments within the military that take a look at these things. But again, if you have run-of-the-mill prisoners, these things may apply. Jim, these people are so bad that their host governments don't want them back. So the point is, you're dealing with very dangerous characters. It's a very small group of people we're talking about, and they have not traditionally been accorded exactly the same level of transparency. However, what they have been guaranteed are their full rights. They have legal representation. They have the ability to appeal in court. They have ability to appeal about the admissibility of evidence. They have all these rights. I mean, all of this is in the law. And furthermore, if somebody is construed to have gone over the line in the questioning, that is something that also can be adjudicated.
But that's the difference here. It's the quality of
It's the unique nature of the detainees.
That allows for a different procedure.
It's a different procedure, but it is the same effort to guarantee representation and human rights. Yeah, Paula.
You said you would follow up on a question yesterday related to common law marriage.
You know what? And I forgot to. I apologize. I'll do that. So what again, is it's common law marriage, whether that...
Well, it's the legal reasoning the administration uses for gay marriage bans, in that you have repeatedly said that the president believes in the sanctity of marriage and that marriage should be between man and woman.
Right.
Well, my question is that this legal status is protection under the law is given to unmarried men and women. As long as they live together.
And, I guess the reason it hasn't come up is that I'm not sure that there have been any shacking up bans. But when they arise, it might be time for an official opinion.
Well, if I may ask one other question then.
Yeah, sure.
With respect to domestic partners.
Yeah.
Is there any reason or why is that not used as discriminatory if a man and a woman who are unmarried get the same protections under the law as a married man and woman, but domestic partners aren't given the same
protections? That is something, again, this gets you into federalism issues, and I would refer that to the several states which have different ways of treating it. Okay, thank you.